And welcome to Life Matters on RN, Natasha Mitchell with you, and something a little different for our Easter Monday show for you. Simon Winchester had a long and illustrious career as a foreign correspondent and journalist, covering many of the historic events of the last 30 years, venturing across the world. You'll recall his tremendously popular book, The Surgeon of Crowthorne, and many since. Today we're venturing across the Atlantic with him in an extended conversation I had with him at the Melbourne Writers Festival in 2010 to talk about his book Atlantic, a vast ocean of a million stories. And if ever there was a man to take on the biography of a 200 million year old ocean, well, Simon is it. He's produced a sweeping history that goes back to day dot, the beginnings of the ocean, charting the highs and lows of our human relationship with this vast expanse of water, including the Atlantic slave trade and, of course, today's story of overfishing and climate change. So let's kick off with why Simon describes the Atlantic as the classic ocean of our imaginings and how it differs, he thinks, from the ocean many Australians know so intimately, the Pacific.
It's not the same as the Pacific, insofar as, although there is a part of it which is blue seas and trade winds and palm trees leaning into the breeze, I think most people, when they think of the Atlantic, think of it as being a grey industrial ocean of fishing vessels and cargo ships and storms and privation. And there's very little sort of Conradian about it, very little sort of Robert Louis Stevenson about it. This is a working ocean.
A
boy's own paper ocean. Yes. So grey, I think, is its colour, even though I'm not silly enough to realise that there aren't parts of it that are blue. But overwhelmingly, I think of it as a grey ocean.
It's interesting. People have described this sort of genre of biography of an object or an entity, a thing, as a sort of genre of the inanimate biography. And I wonder how you feel about that, because I felt like there was sort of more animation in this than many people's lives.
Yes, I mean, you're the first person to use that phrase. To me, I'd never heard of it. But Peter Ackroyd wrote the Thames, a biography, and he wrote London, a biography. So already this idea of writing a biography of a non-human entity has evolved in the last decade or so. But I think the reason that Peter, and now to a different extent I, have been drawn to this is that they're so manifestly living things. I mean, not only did it have a birth, not only will it have a death, but during the time that we're aware of it, the 200,000 or so years when humankind is settled on its shores and goes across it and so forth, we're very clear, are we not, that this is a living, breathing, angry, sad, contented, furious, noisy being. I mean, it pulsates with life underneath its surface, all the fish and whales and things, life above it, all the ships and so on and so forth. So I think inanimate is the one thing that it's not. It's a highly animated, much more animated than the Rocky Mountains or the Dividing Range or whatever. They're ever static, or at least in a geological sense, of course, they're mobile too. But the Atlantic looks mobile. So I think inanimate biography, we need to refine that term, I think.
We're talking about, 82 million square kilometres, or a quarter of the world's ocean mass?
It is. I mean, it's not the largest ocean. Of course, your ocean, at least the ocean on your eastern shores, is far and away bigger, the great unblinking eye of the earth, as some poet once wrote.
Beautiful.
But it seems to me, and with no disrespect, and indeed I wrote a book about the Pacific Ocean about 20 years ago, which was, it was not a success. I mean, it was a very ill, before anyone jumps in and says, I confess entirely that it was a very juvenile book, and it didn't work. But I think I had this idea, I wrote it when I lived in Hong Kong, that this was, quote, the ocean of the future. And it may well be, but what it wasn't, and once again with no disrespect to the Polynesian navigators and so forth, it wasn't the ocean of humankind's past, that the Atlantic is where most of the great events that define contemporary civilization, or many of them at least, occurred. I mean, like the birth of democracy, for a start. And you can repeat this kind of claim for all manner of things. I mean, wireless and telegraphy and air travel and container ships and the regulation of trade and all of them were created in the Atlantic, and the same with respect cannot be said for the Pacific.
It is an ocean of a million stories, or possibly multi-millions of stories, and you struggled, you puzzled over how to embrace all those in one telling. And Will Shakespeare came to the rescue, I gather.
He did, yes. I mean, I carry about with me all the time a slim book of poems, an anthology by David Owen, who was the British Foreign Secretary. And he called the anthology Seven Ages. And it divides the poetry that he likes into the Seven Ages of Man from As You Like It. And I was reading it one day, crossing the Atlantic, somewhere over, I mean, off the coast of Newfoundland. And I had been thinking for many years, if I ever were to tackle a subject as daunting as the Atlantic Ocean, how on earth do you corral all the fascination into a manageable form? When I read the book, I suddenly thought, maybe Shakespeare, The Seven Ages of Man, would provide a structure which I hope isn't in your face, as it were, when you're reading the book. There aren't Shakespearean references all over the place. It's a bit like the lost wax technique in sculpture, that provides you the structure, and then you make it disappear.
Mm. All the world's a stage. Let's have a reading. Let's give people an idea of how you came up with this story.
Well, David Owen's book, then, is based essentially on something that you'll know better than me, which is why I have to read it, and you can probably all recite it. But All the World's a Stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, the acts being seven ages. At first, the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face creeping like snail unwillingly to school, and then the lover sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow, then a soldier full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honour, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything.
This is how you decided to tell the story of the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, yes, it just seemed to me that each of those seven ages, you could, with relative efficiency, perhaps that's not the right word, corral significant aspects of the Atlantic's life into it. So the infant is, perhaps I should explain sort of the meta story, if you like. The Atlantic was born 200 million years ago. It will die in 170 million years. Sorry, when I say born, Pangaea split asunder, and water, there had always been a finite amount of water on the planet, something, interestingly enough, that is proven through the examination of zircon crystals found in Western Australia, what are known as the Jack Hills zircons.
Mm. So we do have a connection.
A huge connection.
In fact, it started with us.
It did. Certainly the proof started with you, yes. That they were able to show that liquid water, I mean, it may have been very acidic and may have been extremely hot and corrosive and unpleasant, but an awful lot of sloshing about water existed on this planet almost from the year dot, from about 4.3 billion years ago. And that water, once it had, as it were, coalesced into a body of finite size and the continents had popped up, it was squished about and changed shape in a myriad ways over the billions of years. And the shape that we now recognize as the Atlantic, this S-shaped thing, was essentially created about 200 million years ago and achieved its current form about 40 million years ago. But the continents will move again. And when...
It's a lovely image, that this idea of a whole supercontinent being cleaved open. But that thought experiment that you entertain in the book, more than entertain, you're fairly confident that one day it will not exist as it came into being.
Yes, it's wiser people than I am certainly have worked out what they think will happen, which is that essentially the tip of South America will move south and eastwards under what is now the tip of Africa, and it'll sidle up beside Australia and collide with Singapore. So when Cape Horn and Singapore collide, then the last bit of water will be squeezed out of the Atlantic. Africa and South America will be joined again. There'll be a small, what looks a bit like the Mediterranean, remaining where the Caribbean is for a while. Mm. But then in about another 10 million years, that'll have disappeared too, and the water will have gone somewhere else. So, all right, the Atlantic, therefore, will have a life of about, in toto, 400 million years. And more or less in the middle of that 400 million years, there'll be a tiny period of time, about 200,000 years, when we exist. And so the book, or at least the Seven Ages structure, is devoted essentially to those 200,000 years. And it begins the infancy. Well, we obviously won't go through all seven ages, but just looking at infant, that's how human beings first discovered the ocean and what they did when they reached it. And they reached it first, as far as the evidence we know of shows us, at a cave called Pinnacle Point in South Africa. Technically, I have to be honest here, it's about 20 miles to the east of the line that puts it actually in the Indian Ocean. So right. I wish they had slightly diverted themselves.
For your purposes.
But for my purposes, but I can't really blame them. You know, they weren't exactly thinking, well, Mr. Winchester may write about it.
I mean, speaking of infancy, you've had a very long relationship with this ocean. You grew up by this ocean, did you not?
In Dorset, in southwest England. So we went, on our school walks. And that should be explained as well, because what is the Atlantic Ocean? Mm. And there is this body in, of all places, Monte Carlo, which is called the International Hydrographic Organization.
Prince Alfred.
Prince Albert.
Albert, sorry, not Alfred.
Alfred also.
Albert.
He's the first Duke of Edinburgh.
He had a great passion for cartography.
He did. And he had this wonderful ship called the Hirondelle. And he was rather like Hirohito in Japan. He had this great fascination with the sea. And he funded this body called the IHO, gave it offices in Monte Carlo. And they decide what the seas around the world will be named and where their boundaries are. And one interesting, I find it rather interesting, is that when this organization was founded in 1921, one of its first jobs was to publish a pamphlet giving the names and the boundaries of all the world's seas. Mm. And that first publication was, I think, 24 pages long. And it listed everything. Well, so complex has the world become politically now that the current issue, A, is 250 pages long, because there are innumerable more seas, but also has not been published, because there's a dispute, an unresolved dispute between the Japanese and the Koreans over what you call the body of water between the Korean Peninsula and Japan. The Koreans call it the East Sea, and the Japanese call it the Sea of Japan, and they absolutely refuse to agree. And so the IHO says, well, in that case, we can't publish our paper.
You made your first crossing of the Atlantic at age 18, 1963, was it?
Yes.
On the Empress of Britain. And there's a sort of wistful tone around this. This Empress of Britain was not long on the oceans. And in fact, that whole romantic tradition of crossing the seas was truncated as well, wasn't it? Not long.
It
after
was.
That.
I had no idea. I wanted to go over to Canada. I had a year off between school and university and decided I'd like to go and see North America. And so in those days, to get effectively steerage passage on a transatlantic liner was very inexpensive. It was about £50 or so. And yet, buying the ticket, there was such dignity with it. I mean, it was written out by hand on a wonderful piece of cardboard by a man with a sort of pince-nez and and standing behind a marble counter somewhere off St. James's in London. And the whole thing was invested with such dignity. And then the ship itself was a marvelous. The Canadian Pacific called these three liners the White Empresses. Mm. And, you know, for a week it was just, it was magnificent. And then there was this, I'd vaguely forgotten the details of the journey, but Canadian Pacific keeps archives, and so I got the archive material in Montreal on that particular voyage, and there's my little name down there.
Oh, classic.
In a cabin with three women, extraordinarily.
Must have been hard for you.
Happened. No, believe you me, I had no idea.
Why did you describe the journey then as giving you a boding sense of pressing solitude?
I think I needed to get away from this. I was standing on the after deck looking over at the sea. But there was this amazing moment when we were just about coming up to the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And I got up very early in the morning, I think, maybe because of what was going on below. I can't quite remember. And I was standing on the bow, and dawn, there was vague sort of lightening of the grey astern of us, and of course ahead was totally dark, and the rumbling of the ship's motors and the hiss of the waves and so forth. And then suddenly there was the ringing of these bells, and the engine stopped, and the liner just hissed to a stop, and suddenly there was just the waves slapping against the hull and no noise at all. And I didn't know what on earth had happened. And then from far ahead you could hear a noise, and it was a sort of whisper, and then a growl, and then a hum, and then an aircraft appeared out of nowhere. And by this time it was light enough for me to see. It was a Royal Canadian Air Force aeroplane, and it waggled its wings as it got to us and circled us, and then dropped a package by parachute. And we sent out a boat and picked up the package, which turned out to be emergency medical supplies for someone who was unwell and indeed did recover, thanks heavens. Mm. But it just struck me as there was something at that moment, you know, we were in unfathomable depths in the middle of absolute nothing, and then a radio message would summon help from some unseen distant place, and then that help would return and silence would resume, and then we'd resume our voyage. There was just something very memorable about that moment, and I'm very glad it happened to me on that voyage, because it made that voyage more than simply the beginning of a routine series of crossings of the ocean.
It has been a routine. You've crossed something like 500 times since.
Well, I think so, because it's been essentially 50 years now, at least five times a year. That's 10 journeys back and forth, It must be 500 times.
It wasn't always this way. A lot of the story here is about the great fear that people had, and it took an awful long time for people to work out how to actually get out on the Atlantic, didn't it?
It is. I mean, when you think, I mean, most of, and I think if this book has a thesis, it's that that the Mediterranean was the inland sea of classical civilization, and the Atlantic then went on to become the inland sea of modern Western civilization. But insofar as most of the early maritime explorers were confined to the Mediterranean, which is a relatively benign sea, and then you've got the Pillars of Hercules, you've got Gibraltar and Jebel Musa, these two great cliffs, as it were. And beyond that, the character of the sea changes. It's grey and roiling and storm, filled with, apparently, monsters. And everyone, all the classical writers, wrote of it as being something that you would never dare venture into. And if you did, you were in for a terrible time. Mm. But then the Phoenicians did. And they went there, I think, for the most delightful reason, really. They had these little boats which were built for the relatively benign waters of the Mediterranean. And then one day someone decided, about the 7th century BC, to venture out into this unknown, ferocious, terrifying ocean and look for snails, essentially. Because there was this one snail which
as
they had
do.
Found, as one does, yes, which they had found in the Mediterranean, which turns out to have existed in abundance on the coast of what is now Morocco, and specifically near the town of Essaouira. There are these little islands called the Îles Pourpoires, which have these sort of like whelks, they're large gastropods. And when you, they're called Murex brandaris, and when you extract from their veins the purple dye that is contained inside these gastropods, boil it up, you come up with a dye which is utterly indelible and provides the colour for most of the Mediterranean aristocracy, most notably the royal purple, exactly. Mm. And so this substance, which was worth much more than gold, ounce for ounce, was the first substance ever to be traded from the Atlantic Ocean. And that led the first ever explorers to venture out both northwards towards Spain and Portugal and ultimately to Britain and southwards around the coast of Africa. And then that started a trend.
Are there any left, little of those snails?
Well, they're on the Moroccan banknotes, the 200 dirham notes. And you can find them, but not very many, apparently, no.
Would you think that there's an Atlantic community, given that it's so vast? If you think about, you have the Americas, you have Europe, you have Africa, Newfoundland, you know, it's so vast. Is there an Atlantic community?
That's a different... I mean, Walter Lippmann said there was. I mean, he wrote in the 1940s that there clearly was a community of interests. And, of course, we have things like NATO and so forth, which are... But is there something that links a Liberian fisherman with a Newfoundland fisherman? Is there anything that links someone in Bermuda with someone in Namibia? And I suppose you'd have to say, no, there isn't. And yet, oddly enough, there is. There is something that binds them all together, but it is the sea. But they don't realize it until you step away from them. And it's easier for us to realize when you draw back and look at the big picture than for the individual participants. For instance, a good example of this is Nova Scotia and Morocco. They're geologically essentially identical in many ways. They're what are called congruent margins because they split apart. And so that's... You know,
it's lovely seeing that sort of imprint of ancient history on the landscape, isn't it? That's your great first love of geology.
Well, yes. But I know it sounds a bit vague and waffly, but there is a community between, a community of behaviour between the fishermen of Morocco and the fishermen of Nova Scotia and Newfoundland. And that kind of thing you find being echoed unexpectedly. There's a sort of twinning in the design of boats and the kind of fish and all sorts of things.
There's a truly dreadful history that connects this ocean and the land masses adjacent to it. And that is the story of the transatlantic slave trade. And you go into incredibly moving depth in this book. What was it like revisiting that history?
Well, I mean, it's horrifying. I mean, what was known as the triangular trade, where and it has to be said, often British slavers, including people who wrote, it was regarded as something which was a God-given right to have slaves. And so you get people who were eminently respectable. Clergymen would own slaving ships. And they would send them down from ports like Bristol to what is now Ghana, to these notorious slaving castles like Cape Coast Castle. And then they were put on these ships which had brought trade goods down from Britain to Africa, so that they bring manufactured goods down from Britain. They would sell them to traders in Africa in exchange, well, often for metal bars, which would then be exchanged for slaves. The slaves would be shackled, manacled, assembled in these castles, sent through the gates of no return onto the slave ships, which had now been hastily modified to accommodate slaves in dreadful conditions. I mean, 3 or 4 feet only of headroom, men, women, and children stuffed in them like so many logs of wood, and then taken on this infamous transatlantic voyage known as the Middle Passage to ports like Charleston and Savannah or to staging posts in the Caribbean islands like Barbados and Jamaica. And then once the slaves themselves or those that had survived the journey were sold, and some by prearrangement or else there was what's called the slave scramble, where the American dealers would rush aboard and say, I'll have him, I'll have her, and lead them off to whatever sort of life was in store for them. And then the boats would be scrubbed down with lye and carbolic acid to remove all the excrement and unpleasantness that had accumulated. And then goods like tobacco and cotton would be loaded on these same boats, and they'd go back to Bristol. And so every leg of this journey was profitable for the ship owners. But this
it's
terrible,
just
terrible middle
human
passage,
beings.
It was dreadful. And the story is that there's one quoted about a child that wouldn't eat and the way that the captain of the slave ship insisted that it ate because he didn't care whether they ate or not, except he needed to deliver them in good condition. And so feeding them a basic, basically nutritious food is akin to feeding cattle. And if they wouldn't eat, then you just throw them overboard. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Millions of people over two centuries.
And the last slave who had endured the Middle Passage died only as recently as 1935, who had been brought over in a ship to Mobile, Alabama, in the late 1890s. An extraordinary story. And so there are recordings of him, his reminiscences, which were dreadful.
It's hard to move from that, as you do skillfully in the book, from these sort of tawdry tales of horror, back and forth into the depths of the ocean and back into the outwards into the human to explore the human history. Benjamin Franklin was fundamental to our understanding of the circulations of the ocean.
Yes, well, Benjamin Franklin, as I'm sure you know, was many things, but he was colonial postmaster general in colonial America and then went on to be the first U.S. postmaster general. And he was in charge of the packet ships which brought packets of mail from Falmouth in southwest England to either Halifax or Boston or New York. And these packets, I mean, they were regular ships. This began in the 18th century. And you could post a letter in London, as long as I think it was by 10 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, the letters would be put into a leather packet, which is why the ships were called packet ships, taken by stagecoach down to Falmouth, loaded onto these ship, which would take other cargo as well, but it was called a packet ship because it held the Royal Mail. And it would make passage across what was called the uphill way of crossing the Atlantic. Uphill was against the prevailing winds. Downhill was much quicker to go from New York back to Falmouth. And then with some reliability and regularity, a letter posted in the first week of January in London would be read in New York on the third week of February, which is probably as good as the British postal system today. I don't know what it's like here in Australia, but it's pretty... But then Franklin noticed that the masters of these ships would report curious and inexplicable speedings up of their schedules, particularly if they headed north. They would find that their ship would be seized by a current and whisked to the north and to the west, and they would, if they followed the current, make much better time. And conversely, if you're beating against the current, you're slowed down terribly by it. And he plotted the reports of these masters and was able to produce what was effectively the first ever map of what is unarguably the most significant, at least to Western Europeans, current in the Atlantic, and that is, of course, the Gulf Stream. Mm. So among his many, many other achievements, Ben Franklin mapped the Gulf Stream for the first time.
The seafarer's friend.
Very much the seafarer's friend, yes. No, he was a great hero. He deserves a book.
There were lots of attempts to communicate across the Atlantic, and the story of the laying of the cables on the first attempt to do that in the late 1800s, I think it was, or mid-1800s. When Marconi came along and that wonderful moment...
I love that moment, yes.
There was a claim that this was technically impossible and morally impugnant, that he would try.
Yes, but I mean, who, of course, is going to say that? The owners of the transatlantic cables, who thought that we can't possibly have transmission of signals without a cable, and they had a 50-year monopoly. And so Cyrus Field, who was the big backer of the main transatlantic cable, actually tried to go to court to prevent Marconi continuing his experiments. But the scene of these Marconi's employees on a clifftop at a place called Poldhu in Cornwall, sending out endlessly, night and day, the letter S.
The letter S.
And then over in Newfoundland on Signal Hill, in just north of St. John's, Marconi and his assistant, Mr. Kemp, sitting there equally night after night listening. And they hoist a kite with an aerial attached to it, and it's about 500 feet up. And there's a howling wind, and it's raining, and it's cold, and the two of them are sitting on this clifftop with Marconi listening intently. And then suddenly his face lightens up and he hands the earphone to Mr. Kemp and says, "Do you hear that, Mr. Kemp?" And sure enough, and you realize it's possible for a signal to be transmitted 1,800 miles. And instantly the lawsuit arrived from Cyrus Field saying, stop this, this is repugnant, it's against the law. But then Edison chimed in from New Jersey and said no.
Who had all the power, really, didn't he, the cachet?
Edison had the cachet and said no, Marconi is the man.
Let's not lay down those optic fibres, hey folks. There are so many stories here, but let's come to this one. Something peculiar is happening to the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, right, yes. Well, you're thinking of Greenland.
And beyond.
And beyond. Well,
whole story, you do a sort of health check, don't you, of the Atlantic?
Yes,
towards the end.
And this is where I potentially get into trouble because I enter the whole debate on climate change and global warming. I begin that chapter with the description. I had been on a big expedition to East Greenland in 1965, and we had been sledding on the ice cap for about 2.5 months at the southern end of a very big fjord called Scoresbysund, and the icebreaker that was going to take us home would arrive at the northern end of Scoresbysund. So when we arrived at the southern end, there should have been a little Eskimo boat or Inuit boat to pick us up and take us to the icebreaker and we go home. But we were horrified to find, when we breasted the top of the hill, that the fjord was filled with ice that had blown in from the Denmark Strait during the late summer. And so we had a very difficult time, but we eventually got to our little boat by walking over these crazed ice flows, and it took many days.
And having to hunt animals in
order
to survive.
Well, hunting animals,
and
yes,
it's
exactly.
A dramatic moment in the book.
Well, it was a dramatic moment in my
life.
Yeah. but the bigger point is that this blow in of ice, which happened occasionally back in the 1960s, to the inconvenience. I mean, they didn't know that a university expedition was going to be inconvenienced, and the Eskimos can deal with this sort of thing, but we were ill-equipped so to do. But it happens nowadays, but it never happens in August. It rarely happens in September, and it often doesn't happen till October because the ocean's getting warmer. And, of course, the locals regard this as great because they can go out and hunt narwhal and things later and later in the season. But it's just an indication that peculiar things are happening. The ocean is getting warmer. The glaciers are breaking up more frequently. The sea levels are rising, you know, and how are we all going to deal with it? How's Rotterdam dealing with it? How's New York dealing with it? How London's dealing with it?
And on Life Matters on Radio National, an Easter Monday special, a conversation with acclaimed British writer Simon Winchester on his extraordinary and rollicking history of the Atlantic Ocean. We recorded this at the Melbourne Writers Festival. And so let's come to questions from the audience who joined us there.
Just going on from the fisheries in the Atlantic, do you cover the changes in pH of the ocean and what's happening there?
I do. If I can slightly expand this question, the beast I'm really interested in is this thing called Prochlorococcus.
It's a lovely cyanobacteria, isn't it?
It's an amazing bacterium which was only discovered 10 years ago and yet is almost certainly the most numerous creature in the world. One in five of the breaths we take comes from Prochlorococcus, which lives in the sea, close to the surface, in waters of a specific pH. That's why there is actually a link to what you've asked. But there's something very interesting, I think, about it, which is related very much to global warming. Prochlorococcus, which is, it eats carbon dioxide, to put it crudely, and emits oxygen. So it's a good creature. It loves warm water. The warmer, the better. It exists between 42 north and 42 south. And I have this fancy, it's completely unproven, so it's purely a fancy,
that it'll compensate.
Well, precisely, that as the world's oceans becomes warmer, it will become more numerous and extend to, let's say, 45 north and 45 south, and will eat up the carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gases that we're so irresponsibly emitting, thereby proving James Lovelock's Gaia theory that the world is a self-regulating mechanism, that the world gets into trouble, thanks to us, perhaps, and it takes care of itself. The world has the last laugh, I believe so.
Yes. Another comment and question. Thank you.
Well, just reference to the Atlantic and the Pacific, that at the time the expansion was going on in the Atlantic, coincidentally, to make it sound dramatic, the Chinese emperor decided to withhold travel. And so that prevented, I suppose, this homogeneity of one population, as it did in the Atlantic, the Europeans going to America. Therefore, the Chinese couldn't go to America from the other side. And would you be able to say, therefore, that that really has prevented the possibility that the Pacific could become like the Atlantic on the basis that there will be geopolitical differences that won't make that?
That is a fascinating thought, that the emperor who prevented Cheng Ho, successors to Cheng Ho, travelling in the 15th century, that one man's edict could have prevented the essentially the globalization of the Pacific. It's an extraordinary thought. And of course, people like Gavin Menzies have been writing books essentially talking about that kind of thing. Insofar as Asians came to North America over the land bridge, which of course never existed in the Atlantic, I think that would have taken care to a far greater degree of the population of North America by what are now Native Americans. I somehow think that the Chinese, had they been given the permission, as it were, to travel, would have largely travelled, given the prevailing winds and so forth, probably would have travelled south. So it would have been the Philippines, it would have been Australia, and indeed westwards into the Indian Ocean itself. We're only talking 500 years, 600 years, not a very long time. And there had been already a great deal of population over the land bridge. So I sort of feel in my bones it would have been relatively insignificant.
Any other feelings in people's bones? Thank you.
Simon, the talk you've given today about the book essentially looks westward from Europe. Are there stories also of the Atlantic from the classical American societies as well, the Mayans, the Aztecs?
Well, yes, and I do go into that as well. I mean, after all, there's this story that Columbus, when he went to Ireland, met North American natives. I shouldn't say met, because they were dead. But he saw the bodies of two native Newfoundland, the Beothuk or the Boothuk, I never remember how to pronounce it. But anyway, we don't know if it's apocryphal. It's a marginal note that he made in a document which suggests that he saw native North Americans in Ireland in 1489 or so. And there's lots of anecdotal, there is anecdotal evidence of possibility of Carib voyagers ending up in, well, as far east as Cairo, in fact, and traces of things like coca leaves found in tombs in Africa, which suggests there may have been some voyage going east about rather than the west about voyages that we know of. So I've tried to cover it in the book fairly, but there's precious little evidence.
It's a reminder of the histories we don't know, we don't hear, but may well have been real and true.
Well, yes, and the thing, and this is talking about westbound voyages, the thing that I really want to try and upset is the absolute primacy of Christopher Columbus. I mean, he never got to North America. He never knew where he was anyway on the four voyages that he did make to the Western Atlantic, and he behaved reprehensibly. I mean, he was an awful, awful man. And yet he is memorialized, you know, the District of Columbia and Columbus, Ohio, and you know, he's all over America. And yet the one person that we do know 500 years beforehand did get to the North American continent, Leif Erikson, who made a settlement in the northern tip of Newfoundland, is entirely forgotten.
The son of Eric the Red, they
son
say.
Of the Eric the Red, yes. And they had a child. They had a settlement. They had cattle. They settled down peacefully. They didn't massacre people. They didn't do anything unpleasant at all. They just lived there peaceably enough to conceive a child, and called Snorri Thorfinnsson, I think, who then died back in Denmark, or maybe it was Iceland. So European contact with North America, why isn't it the district of Erikson? Why is Columbus? Well, someone said because Americans these days much prefer pizza to lutefisk. And I see their point.
We've got time for, I think, one or two final questions. Thank you.
My question concerns the demise of the Atlantic. Could you make a few comments about the opening up of the Northwest Passage and the connection of the Atlantic to the Pacific?
Well, yes, both the Northwest and the Northeast Passage, of course. So clearly global warming is having a profound effect on potential patterns of trade. So important, fascinating, but is it going to displace the container ship traffic between Baltimore and Liverpool, or between Buenos Aires and Lisbon. I doubt it somehow. I mean, that the amount of traffic, sea traffic, which in itself is also polluting, is quite extraordinary. I was stunned not only to see the air traffic control tracks of aircraft looking absolutely solid. I mean, 414,000 flights a year across the North Atlantic, but also the tracks that ships leave nowadays. There are plumes of smoke in great lines between, let us say, Liverpool and Baltimore. So however much there is potential for traffic through the Northwest Passage, it's still relatively complicated for masters to do, and I think it'll be some years before it'll displace the Panama Canal and traffic across the Atlantic itself. But it's clearly coming, unless, of course, global warming is cyclical and everything starts freezing up again.
We have to finish up. So from the deep past to the future present, please thank Simon Winchester.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Simon Winchester joining us at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. You're with Life Matters here on RN, and I was really struck by the stories from the audience of Australians who had memories of travelling across the Atlantic on boats. And I wonder if you've got an Atlantic yarn. Get in touch via our webpage, abc.net.au/radionational/lifematters. Leave us a comment on the story there, or send us an email, or you can Facebook us. Just search RN Life Matters. Well, coming up, let's continue our bookish theme for this long weekend. Perhaps you're kicking back and having a bit of a bookish weekend. Perhaps you're a book clubber. We'll meet one that's been meeting for 20 years in the top end.